Hello and a very warm welcome back to Wellness with Liz Earle. And today I'm joined by University of Cambridge geneticist and BBC presenter Dr. Giles Yeo. Now, with over 20 years experience in this field, Giles was part of the initial vanguard that discovered a number of genes that cause severe obesity and also the pathways in the brain that influence our eating habits. He's joining me in the studios today to discuss his new book, Gene Eating, which in his own words is a structured diatribe against dietary misinformation backed up by bad or no science. So today we'll be debunking weight loss myths and exploring if our genes are really to blame when our genes don't fit. Haha. Welcome, Giles.
Hello, Liz. Thank you so much for having me.
It's just great because this is such a big, big subject and obviously very relevant as we get into the warmer weather and start stripping off and becoming more body conscious and body aware. And all the diet books come out at this time of year, don't they?
They do. Bikini bod, beach bod season.
Oh, I actually wrote one called The Bikini Diet years ago.
Did you?
I did, many, many years ago, not to my shame, but it was a catchy title, but it was basically all about eating well.
Right.
But obviously
you, are you telling me you actually coined the term?
Well, I don't know if I was first. My Bikini Diet book came out, 25 years ago. So does that give me a bit of ancestry there, maybe?
You don't look it.
You are very kind. Mm. For you, though, going back in time, when did you first get into genetics? Has it always been your thing?
I mean, always been our thing is a very odd thing to say. I did it as an undergrad. So in other words, I went and, you know, when I did science as an undergrad, but what was that? And then I found my way specializing in genetics. And I guess I'd always been interested in what makes us similar and also what makes us what makes us different.
Yeah. Always at Cambridge? Was that always, has that
no,
always
my
been
undergrad, my undergraduate was... So I'm from San Francisco. I don't sound like my wife's English. But so I did my undergraduate at the University of California at Berkeley.
Okay.
So I did it. I did it in genetics, pretty much. But then I moved to Cambridge to do my PhD, also in genetics. But oddly enough, on the genetics of Japanese pufferfish. So
curious.
Yeah. But then when I finished that, I realized that studying the genetics of Japanese pufferfish was not going to pay my mortgage, and that was when then I moved into obesity.
Okay, that's very interesting. And did you come across, or do you come across now, people like Tim Spector working in genetics with the Twins Project and
absolutely. So
and...
I have collaborated with Tim
previously,
and we know each other. Yeah.
Yeah. Fantastic. Mm. Well, I'm podcasting with him soon too because it's all interconnected, isn't it? The role of microbiome and genes and I know that you've done a really interesting series for Audible on gut health and genetics, and that was really interesting to hear your take on that because I'm obviously big into gut health as well.
I mean, it is all one unit. I mean, whenever we talk about, not only when we talk about health, but when we talk about diet and we talk about health, it is, you cannot separate everything apart. It all works as one whole.
Mm.
And so when you talk about the gut, that's such a huge part of it. If you talk about the brain and you talk about your genes and it all is one whole. And so it's all just different, sides of the same kind of like pyramid.
Of the same thing. So what role then do our genetics play in all of that? I mean, do we have fat genes that mean we're always going to be overweight?
I mean, there are no fat genes per se. I put it another way. I mean, we now know of over 200 genes that influence our body shape and body size. Okay. And it's not like these definitely make you fat or definitely make you thin. Imagine that each of these individual 200 genes, one increases your likelihood of slightly making you heavier and one variation makes you slightly lighter. Okay. So there are two versions of each gene. And so each of us have our own individual mix of these 200 genes that make us average size, maybe slightly heavier, maybe slightly lighter.
When you say slightly, what are we talking about?
Oh, like
10%, 20%?
Everywhere on the spectrum. So there are going to be some people who have so many of these genes that they end up, being likely to become obese. You know, whether we were talking,
yes.
Obese. Some that make people really skinny. But obviously the vast majority of us sit somewhere in the middle, right? Oh, I'm a couple of pounds too heavy. Ooh, I just wish I could gain a couple of pounds.
Yeah.
And so it's a complete spectrum.
And are we seeing the gene structure changing? So are we developing more of the genes that make us more overweight? Or does our gene pool pretty much stay the same?
So these genes and these variations have, I would say, always been there. Clearly not always been there, but have been there probably for the last 100,000 years.
So we can't really blame our genes. We can't blame changes or shifting genes for our increase in society for being overweight.
No, we can't. So I think that, okay, here's the new ones, I guess. Undoubtedly, it's society, the environment, our diet, etc., etc.
Mm.
Okay, everything non-genetic that has driven the obesity problem, the problem with diet-related illnesses that we actually see today. However, not all of us are fat or ill in this environment. And that is where our genes actually play a role.
So that's the nuance, isn't it?
Yeah.
And that's where other things like microbes and all the other influences potentially could come in.
Yes, absolutely. Mm. I consider the microbes more part of the environment. They almost sit at the interface between mm-hmm. the environment and our genes, because they are influenced by our genes. But they're also influenced by the environment, what we eat, where we live.
Yeah.
And so the microbes are one of the interface between the two, our genes and the environment, I think.
Fascinating. I loved your book, Gene Eating, which I know we'll come on and talk about. And
mm.
what I thought was really interesting, possibly a tad depressing, I'm not sure, is the
My wife finds it depressing,
oh,
but
no,
there we go.
Really? Mm. Well, you talk about this thing called the set point.
Yes.
Which is the kind of the weight that we're almost always going to be. And we can vary, we can go on a crash diet or whatever, and we can shift a few pounds, but we will always revert to our set point. Is that really the case, that we are what we are and there's very little we can do about it?
I mean, a set point, maybe I should have used a different term. The set point is the term used in the past. It's probably a set range. So I don't think it is a single point in time, and I think you can definitely move up and down. But there is a natural body weight that we find easy to maintain, okay? It tends to be 5 pounds or 10 pounds above what we'd like it to be most of the time. But I think most of us accept the fact that if we're not trying, really, we'll probably sit slightly above what we'd like, and we stay there. Then we try and force ourselves down, we try and diet, and then it's difficult. Whereas if we go, and so that range, that 10 pounds above what we love to be, that is what we call the set
okay,
range.
Okay, and that's around 10 pounds, is it?
Oh,
so
no, I mean, I made up 10 pounds.
Take.
It's going to be, it really is going to be depending on people. Depending on each of us individually. I mean, for some of us, you can see there are going to be people out there who are congenitally skinny. They're just skinny. And they say, well, I don't try and be skinny. I'm not morally superior. I'm just like this. And so their set points or set range is going to be lower. Me, I wish I was 5 pounds lighter. So there we go. And whereas I can maintain my body weight now with no real thought about it, but if I need to lose that extra 5 pounds, it's a real pain.
I totally resonate with that. I find exactly the same. I can get to a certain point and I'm reasonably happy and on the metrics, whatever you look at, you go, I'm within a healthy range, but I would love to be 5 or 6 pounds lighter. And it's a struggle.
It is.
I just can't get down there. And when I do, I only have to go out for a couple of nights.
It comes back up again.
Ping, it's all back up again. So, I'm kind of now thinking, having read your work, is there actually any point in fighting that?
I think there are two different things. Is there a problem in carrying too much fat, in carrying too much weight? Yes, there is, because it increases your risk of all kinds of diseases.
Yeah.
Okay. How does that square your healthy weight? How does that square with being beautiful? Okay.
Or and I think,
or what society
would say
is being
beautiful.
And I think that is the problem, right? So I think we need to be worried about our health.
Sure.
And to my mind, if we concern ourselves about our health and work towards that, then our weight will take care of itself.
Mm.
And it may not be that you end up looking like Angelina Jolie or what have you.
Mm.
But then at least you will be healthy.
Within a healthy range. And,
yes.
And for you as a geneticist working with obesity, I mean, you must be super busy, because this is a fast growing market, isn't it?
I don't think I'm going to run out of a job anytime soon, sadly. But yeah, it is a fast growing market.
And what is the main trigger then? What is causing this huge range? Or is that a massive question to answer simply?
No. Well, what is causing it is almost easier to answer than why we behave differently in it. Okay. So undoubtedly what's causing it, what's driven it, is the change in our environment. Now, I'm using environment in its loosest terms. I mean, the environment, yes, but the type of food we eat, our socioeconomic class, the fact that we're sat here talking to each other rather than working in a coal mine,
sure.
The fact that we have dishwashers, yes. and the fact that we can get food 24 hours a day, pretty much, very, very cheaply, wherever we want, wherever we are. So I think it's a mix of those two. The fact that we have our lives have changed so much in terms of what we do for a living, and the fact that the type of food we're exposed to and eat has changed so much. That, those two together, is what has driven the diet, the epidemic, I'm going to use the word epidemic, of diet-related illnesses that we actually see today.
So how many of us are obese in the UK?
In the UK,
what sort of proportion?
I think the number, it depends on how you actually, you know, define it, but anywhere from a quarter to a third.
Good heavens.
More than, if we consider overweight,
yes.
So you know, we're probably 50 to 60% of us are probably overweight.
So more than half of us are
overweight. More than over half of us are overweight. Now, you know, does overweight necessarily mean unhealthy? Probably not. It does increase your risk, but then tilting into obesity, that is when we actually have the issue. But it's a huge problem. It's in the world today, there are actually, and this is a scary statistic, there are more people, okay, even though they're overnutritioned, okay, that are actually at risk of having disease because they're too large compared to the number of people who are actually at risk of starving to death. We've actually tilted. Yes, tipped. Where more people are going to die because of carrying too much fat than because they are dying of starvation.
That is really, I mean, that is quite shocking, because we know the numbers, sadly, who are dying of starvation are still, you know, running.
Are still running at a
multi-million.
Absolutely.
Way, way too high. Mm. It sounds almost perverse then to talk about losing weight when we know that there are so many who are, you know, food deprived, and we've got this ridiculous sense of imbalance where we are just so overstuffed literally on every level with foods. But for those of us who are part of the 60% overweight who are wanting to do something about it, you have forensically examined all the different types of dieting and seen, you know, what's working and what's working. The number one thing that I grew up with as a youngster was counting calories. You know, it seems to make sense. You've got, you know, a certain amount of calorific value going in, and then you cut that down and, you know, bingo, you lose loads of weight. So what's your view? Should we be counting calories?
I think the only way to lose weight, the only reason why we're gaining weight is because we're eating more than we burn. Hence, the only way to lose weight is to eat less than you burn. Okay,
so eat less, do more.
Exactly.
So that doesn't write a book, does
no,
it?
No, but that's the physics. That's the physics. Okay. Where the interesting bits come is in why we actually behave differently. Okay, around food, why we behave differently around food, and why some people are more efficient than others. It's even though we have to get to the physics. So anything which is going to get us to lose weight has to achieve this the physics.
So your basic dynamic then is eat less and do more.
That's it. But the strategy of which you actually achieve that is then going to differ. Now, calorie counting is an interesting concept. Clearly, you know, what is a calorie? A calorie is the amount of energy that is going to need to raise 1 liter of water, 1 degree Celsius. That is the actual definition of
a
calorie.
That's the physics.
That's the physics. That's the physics. So therefore, if you've actually absorbed a calorie in you, clearly all calories are equal. The problem is, whenever we eat something, so this is from a pure calorie counting point of view, whenever we eat something, okay, we cannot absorb every single calorie. So I'll give you some examples. I use these in a book. If you have 100 calories, this is called caloric availability. Okay, so the amount of calories you absorb from a food versus the amount of calories stuck in the food. If you have 100 calories of sugar, just the pure white stuff, okay, and you eat it, you probably get 98 to 99 calories out of that 100 calories of sugar. It's nearly 100% calorically available. If you have 100 calories of sweet corn, and then you peek in the loo the next day, you clearly have absorbed nowhere close to 100 calories of sweet corn. Yet, when you take corn kernels, dry it up, pound it into a corn meal, and make a corn tortilla, you can suddenly absorb a lot more of the calories within the corn. But yet, when you go to your favorite supermarket and look at the back of these packages at the calories, it's still 100 calories of sugar, 100 calories of sweet corn, and 100 calories of corn tortilla. So calorie counting blind, you know, makes no sense to me.
No, because what is your body doing with those calories?
Yes.
How is it interpreting it? It'll use some of them really efficiently and you'll potentially gain more weight. Some of them it won't be able to utilise and you can eat more and not put on any weight.
Because, exactly. And if you consider, so there are two, that is the first concept. And, mm-hmm. and there are two key concepts, which in my mind, just thinking about it and reflecting on it, probably explain how most of diets work. So that's the first one. Mm-hmm. The fact that that you may count calories, but certain foods, you can't absorb all the calories. The second concept is the fact that something that takes longer to digest travels further down the gut.
Yes.
Therefore, it makes you feel fuller. Therefore, it makes you eat less. So
yes.
Protein is a classic example of this, where protein is just chemically more. A calorie of protein makes you feel fuller than a calorie of fat, than a calorie of carb, in that order.
Does it really?
It does.
I thought that fat was quite high, but protein's above fat in terms of satiety.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. And the reason behind that is because of all those three macronutrients.
Yes.
I was doing air quotes there. macronutrients. Protein takes the longest to digest. So if you take those two concepts and those two principles,
yeah.
You actually explain how almost all diets work to get you to eat less. Let's take an example. Atkins diet. This one was the granddaddy of all these famous diets. Often sold as a low carb diet. Okay. But if you remove the carbs, then you need to replace the calories with something else. And yes, people do replace it with fat, but actually, fat is pretty unpalatable in of itself.
Yes, you know, how much? You're not just going to drink olive oil, are you?
No, exactly. It's just, it's lovely with carbs.
Mm-hmm.
But so a lot of people actually replace it with protein.
Yes.
And protein makes you feel fuller and it makes you eat less and you lose weight from the caloric availability point of view. Now, let's go with carbs. Carbs, caloric availability, so the amount of calories you get from 100 calories of carbs, depends whether or not you're talking about pure sugar or you're talking about bread, okay? But broadly speaking, 95 to 99, 97%, depending on how complex the carbs are. Fat is nearly 99%, nearly 100, because fat is so dense. Protein, all protein on average, is only 70% available. So for every 100 calories of protein you eat, you only, on average,
you're automatically, you got a discount.
That's it.
A 30% discount.
That's
I
correct.
Love it.
You only ever absorb 70 calories. This is why high protein diets work for weight loss in the short term. Now, before everyone on here goes to buy steak, just to be clear that any form of protein will work wherever it comes from. It doesn't have to be meat. It can be tofu. It can come from beans.
Yeah.
Protein is protein.
Mm-hmm.
And that same principle actually will hold. And if we then pick apart a gazillion diets that are out there, those two principles, I almost guarantee will explain how the diets work. So therefore, this is how it works from a biological point of view. Very, very seldom is it the reason why the websites and the people selling the diets tell you how it works.
Interplaying into all of this, of course, is the importance of food diversity and lots of veg, which are going to feed your microbes. And even though vegetables contain lots of carbs, they're the good carbs, aren't they? And to your point about eating sweet corn and then seeing all the husks in the loo the following day, you know, we're not absorbing all that extra fibre. It's helping.
So the fibre is the critical element here, because what the fibre does, so if you have lots of vegetables, is the fiber does two things. The fiber slows the release of carbohydrates within it, so you get a more even release of carbohydrates compared to just eating refined carbohydrates, okay? Which means all the calories going boom, whereas fiber slows everything down. It makes you feel fuller.
Yes.
Fiber also travels further down the gut, also makes you feel fuller. Fiber also feeds and makes the microbes happy. So fiber is fabulous for those three different reasons. It's good for you. It's good for you. I cannot, if there is anything close, there's no such thing as a superfood. But if there's anything close to it, something high in fiber probably is it.
So it's really interesting to hear that the two basic principles that we should be looking for going forward with our healthy eating is good amounts of good quality protein and good amounts of
fiber,
fruit and vegetables, fiber.
Yes.
And very little sugar. I mean, what is the role of refined sugar here? Because I sometimes have arguments on social media with people who I suspect are in the play of, Mr. Kipling or whoever, trying to get us to eat refined carbs and saying, there's no link between, refined sugars and high glycemic index and all of that. Don't worry, just eat a little bit of what you fancy. And I think, no, actually, sugar, I regard sugar as inflammatory and having no benefit to the human body?
I don't know if I think it depends what we're talking about here. We need sugar.
Do we
to
really?
A certain amount. Now, do we need powdered sugar?
Spoonfuls of white sugar.
No. But in the concept of a sugar in of itself, do we need sugar? Yes, we do.
Sugars come from fruit and veg.
Exactly. This is what I mean. Hence, if you have refined sugar, okay, per se, it is not bad for you. We eat too much of it. And I think that's probably the issue. The one thing that I would agree with you on, however, so I draw a distinction between eating the sugar, maybe not eating a teaspoonful of sugar, but eating the sugar within a food and drinking the sugar. And the reason why, so that is where I think we are, I think we're walking the same path here. And the reason behind this is because whenever you're eating something, you're chewing, you salivate, and the whole process of that, your body begins to sense this and prepares itself to receive calories. So this is what. So you need to kind of set yourself up, right?
Okay.
The right enzymes, the right juices, everything in place to say we're going to deal with the food, whatever it is. The problem with drinking it, okay? Now, drinking your calories, bar in milk, breast milk or whatever milk, is actually an unusual thing to do, okay? We drank it as children, as milk.
Yes.
Otherwise, we eat our calories. Okay,
so and you just drink water,
and you just drink water
historically
since whenever, unless you were very, very rich, you know. But most people are not, and so what then happens is if you drink it, your body is not being prepared to receive any calories. You can literally drink 1,000 calories, okay, in what, 2 minutes if you have a full fat fizzy drink, for example, before your body even knows that you've begun the process of consuming a calorie.
So what is happening then inside our bodies? Is it going to major panic stations?
It's not major panic station. The problem is it's in, and because there's no digestion required, because it's sugar, it goes in, it's absorbed very quickly, and then it's in you before your body can actually respond, before the feeling full signals come. So what happens when you're eating is that as food goes through the throat, the stomach and the guts, it releases signals to the brain to tell you, I have had this much carbs, fat, protein and this many calories. So you can then in your head think, how much fat do I have as well? And then merge everything together. Drinking the calories messes those maths up. And so as a result, I mean, eventually your brain will catch up. But if you do this every single time, then you end up fooling your brain has problems trying to catch up with how many calories you're absorbing when you're actually drinking it. So what I think I would definitely back is some way of actually, and by the way, this is not just Coca-Cola, Pepsi-Cola, other colas are available, fizzy drinks.
Yeah.
I also draw the same line down with fruit juices.
I was going to ask you about fruit juice and smoothies and all those other things that we're drinking, shakes, replacement meal shakes, for example.
Yes, that's exactly right. So, okay, I think we have to deal with it one at a time. So fruit juice is probably as bad as a fizzy drink. I actually got into trouble. I wrote this because it's true, because you strip out all the fiber. All the good bits of it have been stripped out. Yes, they are vitamins. I agree.
Yep.
But the fact is the sugar element remains the same. Mm-hmm. I actually attracted the ire of Big Juice and the Florida juice.
Exactly. Happy.
I got a letter from their PR agency in New York. You know you're in trouble when you get a letter from New York.
I once got a letter from a low-fat margarine industry PR many years ago when I wrote my first book on fats and oils for daring to suggest that hydrogenated trans fats weren't good for us.
And you were right.
Well, of course, 20, 30 years later.
It's now banned. No, you can't have hydrogen.
I think you kind of, it's a badge of honor when you receive one of those kind of cease and desist letters.
One of those letters. But so I think we've got to consider, we can't put labels on food that are good or bad willy-nilly. We have to do it with science in mind. And that includes even something which is perceived to be fabulous for you. Look, a little glass of orange juice for breakfast.
Small amounts of fresh, unpasteurized, bursting with vitamins.
Clearly, it's going to be fine. Okay, there's nothing. But if you have a pint of orange juice,
and you just slug it down,
it's got the same amount of sugar, exactly the same amount of sugar as in a cola. Exactly the same amount of sugar. There is no, and people says, yeah, but it's natural sugar.
Nope. Sugar is sugar.
It's the same sugar. Exactly the same sugar that is there. So That is the big distinction which I draw. I think eating it,
yes.
We do eat too much sugar, okay, and I grant you that. But there is a very big, gigantic difference between eating it and drinking it.
So what I try and do with my children is if they have juice, I've cut the serving size down, mm-hmm. and we always dilute it 50-50. So
I mean, that's probably a good idea anyway, because the acid in the juice and teeth for young kids.
I try
kids.
And get them to use a straw as well, just to, you know, to bypass the teeth, because absolutely, you know, the acid.
And not to actually... So my mum, retired now, my mum was a dental nurse, and so this was hammered into me every time she looked at my teeth, even now, you know,
juice.
was just to not... Or if you're going to drink juice... Drink it quickly.
Yes.
You know, don't
swill it around your mouth like a mouthwash.
And for heaven's sake, if you are a mother with a toddler, don't put it into a bottle and get them to almost bathe their teeth in the juice. Don't do that. Yeah. Just do, not only for the acid, but also for the sugar.
For the sugar.
If you're going to drink it in a meal, drink it during the meal. Drink it back. You can do it with water. Don't do that to your kids.
I'm a fan of juicing, but my rule, I try and follow the 70-30 rule. So I try and juice with 70% veg. So lower sugar.
Yes.
I mean, obviously things like beetroot and carrots are high in natural sugars, but there are lots of other, you know, lovely greens and cucumbers and peppers and all the other things that are not quite so high in sugar. So there are ways around it.
There are ways around it. There's nothing wrong with it, but try and keep as much. So when you juice, there are juices now which also do the fiber.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that, I think, is the critical element to it. Mm-hmm. If you strip out the fiber, you want a purely, you know, almost like a consommé. You know, some apple juices come out almost like a consommé.
Yeah,
you look
really
at it and go, oh, my goodness, you know... You want stuff with fiber in it, and that slows down. That actually slows down the absorption and release of the sugar.
So coming on to then things like meal replacements and shakes and smoothies, they do contain a bit of fiber, don't they? Well,
they do
sometimes. They can do.
I think it depends what the purpose of the meal replacement is. I think to my mind, clearly, it's always better to be eating food. Okay,
it's real food.
You know, food like in the shape of food. There are going to be reasons why to use meal. If you're in hospital, if you're an old person, if you need to get as much calories down as you as possible, there are going to be situations for you to actually use that.
Interesting though, that you talk about wanting your calories, so wanting to put on weight.
That's right.
Actually use meal replacements.
That's right. I mean,
not losing weight.
Particularly if you're getting older. I mean, like old with a capital O. Actually, there are very few severely obese old people, because what then happens is you begin to lose muscle mass, you begin, and actually getting enough calories down, this is not universal, but I mean, largely speaking, it's actually difficult for an older person to keep getting enough calories down you. And so that's when something like that was useful.
Absolutely. Well, you must have seen in the course of your work so many different food fads and trends and ideas come along. What about things like alkaline eating? Can we eat to change our alkalinity, and is that important?
So alkaline eating is probably... So most of the diets which I handle in there do work and has some scientific basis.
Okay, so your book, Gene Eating, describes lots of different diets.
Lots of different
ones. Which is
really
helpful, actually, because you can explore
them. And goes through. And I don't demonize everything, clearly, because the one thing I will demonize is alkaline eating.
Okay, go for it.
Because it has no basis in fact whatsoever. So the reason why are two reasons. So alkaline eating, just for people who aren't familiar with it, goes with the principle that because we are alkaline beings, and we are, our blood pH, which is a measure of acidity and alkalinity, is slightly alkaline at 7.4. So 7 is neutral, 7.4, slightly higher, is alkaline. This is a truth. So this is the kernel of truth that is there.
Okay.
Where the fantasy emerges is that this our blood pH can be influenced by what we eat. It cannot. And because anything which you eat has to pass through the stomach. And the stomach has a pH of battery acid. Okay.
Battery acid.
Yes.
Really?
You don't want to stick your hand in there. It's going to be bad for your... You know, stomach's a tough old boot.
It must be.
Yes. And so the food goes in there. The stomach kind of massages it. So whatever you eat at whatever pH becomes fully acidic. Now, when it goes into your intestines, then things happen and everything is natural. So that's the first thing. There is absolutely zero evidence that eating changes your alkaline. Second, if you look at, there are any number of books out there, the founder of the diet is this chap called Robert Young. Okay, he calls himself a doctor. He's not a doctor at all. So he was the one that invented the alkaline diet. So if you go back to his books and look at how he actually calls what are alkaline and acidic, they make no sense whatsoever. So, for example, he considers lemons alkali.
Well, I've read this. This is very confusing. So, why would he do that? And B, what's the reality?
Well, the reality is lemons are full of ascorbic acid, which is vitamin C, and citric acid, because it's a citrus fruit. Okay, so by any definition and measure, it is acidic, but yet he calls it alkali. Here's the problem. He uses the word alkali as for the proxy of the word good. Now, is it good or is it bad? I'm not sure. But this is the problem. So there is no... And he considers meat acidic when meat has blood in it, because that's what meat is. People might not like it, but there does have blood in it. So therefore, it's alkali by its very, very nature. So what is acidic and what is alkali, to his mind, completely makes no sense. Why do people follow it? Why is it so popular? If you actually strip back what you actually eat when you are on an alkaline diet, you are actually eating a lot of veg and very little meat. Okay, now, it's pretty much close to a vegetarian, sometimes even vegan diet, okay, for it. So therefore, you look at it and go, well, if this is why it's good for you, okay? Yeah. The explanation, however, is complete pseudoscience.
Right.
And one thing people do ask is, why does it matter if we can get people to eat more veg and less meat and eat healthier? I think the reason is, if you want to get someone to eat more veg and less meat, and there are good, solid, scientific-based reasons why this is going to be good for you, why not just say it?
Yes.
Why come up with some imagined reasoning in order to try and do that? I know why. It's because, well, either you believe your own myth, or you're trying to find your niche to make cash. Those are the two things, or a mix of both.
Yeah.
Call me cynical.
No, I see it in so many areas. You know, we talk about so many things here on Wellness with Lizelle, and it's either bogus science and wrong information, which is quite scary when you get people who have a position of influence.
Exactly.
Or there's a vested financial interest.
Oh, okay, if there is a vested financial, all of us need to pay our mortgage.
For sure, no, yeah, okay. Everyone's going to work, totally.
But you got to be...
Let's do it credibly.
Yeah, you want to be selling things that A, work, B, make sense, then by all means, go and make your money. But don't do it by lying to people, which is what really bugs me.
Interesting, you mentioned there about eating more veg and following a vegan diet.
Mm.
Now, you did that, didn't you? Was that for a BBC programme?
It was for Trust Me, I'm a Doctor,
okay.
Which I present on. And so they wanted me to ask the question, is it healthy to be vegan? Now, I appreciate, for all the vegan listeners out there, that people go vegan for a myriad of different reasons.
Lots of reasons, yeah.
Ethical reasons, environmental reasons. But this is a health program, so I looked at it from a health perspective. And so the first question was, does vegan automatically equal healthy? Then you begin to think about it, and clearly not, because I could have had chips and crisps and Oreo cookies the entire time.
Yes.
And that would clearly not have fitted under healthy. So I decided to try a plant-based whole food approach, okay, in order to do that. And so I survived the month. And do you know what? I lost 4 kilos on the vegan diet. And my blood cholesterol levels, which I always knew was a tad high, I have to say, dropped by 12%. This was in 29 days. Not that I wasn't counting.
Right.
I'm almost the face of vegan health. I'm the poster boy. Except let's look at why did I lose the weight? Okay. I lost the weight because vegan food is bulkier than meat. You got to eat, it's less calorically available, okay? Lots of fiber. So you got to eat a lot of lentils to match a steak, okay? Mm-hmm. And there's only so much time in a day you have eating. And so as a result, even though I ate loads volume-wise, I still absorbed less calories. And trust me, I was eating as much as I could get down me. I wasn't eating crisps and chips, just to be clear.
Mm-hmm.
I was eating beans, I was eating veg, I was eating carbs, I was eating rice, I was eating pasta, but I was trying to eat but I'm not a big pasta head. And so I lost weight because of that. Okay, but you can lose weight many, many different ways. It wasn't a magical vegan diet. It just was a very good strategy for me. Why did my cholesterol levels drop? Probably because, A, in part, I lost weight.
Yes.
Okay, so that's going to lower it. And second, because I removed saturated fats from my diet.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Largely, this comes from meat. I realize some vegetables have saturated fats, but my saturated fats tended to come from meat-based products. Now, there are two buts, very, very important buts to actually consider here. I could have achieved this drop in cholesterol levels by switching to a pescatarian diet, so eating largely fish, because the fat in there is unsaturated. Mm-hmm. So I didn't need to necessarily go vegan.
Yeah.
And secondly, and most importantly, not everybody's cholesterol levels are sensitive to diet. Now, mine happens to be.
Interesting.
But for a lot of...
So for some of us, it won't work.
It won't work at all. Not one jot. It doesn't matter how much butter you eat or how much kale you eat.
Really?
Your cholesterol levels are either going to be set high, middle, or low, and it's going to be down to your genes.
Yes.
And it's not going to budge. Now, it's high, it's going to be bad, and you're going to need to drop it somehow. Mm. And so my point is, when you take a diet like myself, and I'm in a position of influence because this was broadcast on national TV, so I need to be careful what I say. I can say, go vegan, drop your cholesterol levels, lose weight. That's true for me, and that's probably going to be true for a lot of people.
Yes.
But it's not going to be true for everybody.
For everybody.
And that's the critical message. You have to find a strategy that suits you and your biology for the diet to actually improve your health.
Did you check things like your B12 and your vitamin D?
Yes, I did.
How were they affected? I mean, I know it was only a month.
It was only a month, but I did get everything measured before and I measured everything after. I, surprisingly, actually was vitamin D deficient. Still am, probably. Mm. I need to stay in the sun
a bit more.
But I'm a tropical boy living in a northern rock. So for me, I probably do need vitamin D supplements. Mm. Everything else, all my other micronutrients were good before and good after. Mm. Now, that said, and I didn't supplement, but that being said, that's because B12 in particular, the two things which vegans need to really concern themselves with is B12 and iodine. Okay, so now B12 tends to come from animal-based products and yeast. So that's the thing. But you do need to supplement going long-term. But because it is fat-soluble, I figured I had enough.
It was being released in your fat.
So I didn't supplement.
Yeah.
Iodine, interestingly enough, largely, now, seafood is famously high in iodine. Mm-hmm. Seaweed is famously high in iodine, okay? But actually, in the UK and in the US, the vast majority of our iodine comes from milk.
Yes.
And you might be wondering, why is that the case? Are cows high in iodine? The feed that cows eat is high in iodine. So that tends to be where we actually get it from. But if you're going vegan, you do need to think about a supplement for that as well. So you need to worry. You do need to think about supplementation if you're choosing to go to go vegan long term.
Interesting that you're saying that, you know, there seems to be no one diet fits all, and it's very much to do with our own individual genetics or our microbiome and how that's interacting. How can we identify that? How can we know? Isn't that the sort of $10 million question?
It is. It is. I mean, there are loads of companies out there at the moment who claim to be able to sell you a genetic test for 100 quid or 200 quid or something and predict what you... No, I mean, which is slightly odd when I'm a geneticist.
Yes.
And that's because we're not there yet with regards to the biology. That's the problem. I think we're going to get there at some point, and then we'll be able to get some level of predictivity. But at the moment, actually, do you know what your best approach is? Are two approaches. The first one is slightly depressing. Look at your parents. So if you look at, I know it's terrible. So when you look at your parents, it'll give you a good idea about the kind of diseases you may actually get. And if you look at their parents' shape, now you may differ in absolute size, okay, and severity of various things, but they'll give you a pretty good bioessay, as they say, for what's going to end up happening to you. Very depressing, everyone. I'm really sorry about this. But the second thing, actually, in lieu of a viable genetic test at the moment, I think is to be honest with your feeding behavior. If you're going to want to lose weight, there's no sense in lying to yourself. Okay, say I need to lose weight. Then be honest. Do I like sugary food? Do I like fat food? Do I respond to stress by eating, or do I respond to stress by not eating? It's the same hormone, cortisol. Why do people respond in diametric opposites? I mean, we know people who will stop eating the moment they're stressed. Others comfort eat. So if you know you comfort eat when you get stressed, then put a strategy together that prevents you from comfort eating. Maybe you do something else to tickle the reward centers of your brain in order to do that. If you happen to really like sugary food, well, try not to have as much of it in the house.
Yeah, or wean yourself off. I wean myself off sort of very sweet chocolate by just eating
less, darker, like darker chocolate.
And now that's probably possible too. I absolutely love, you know, 80-90% dark chocolate. But I used to not do it. It took me about a year to kind of work down to that.
But this is what I mean. You know what you what and that is probably the best way to do it. But you have to be honest with yourself. You got to sit down and say what really floats my boat, okay? and then try and work within there to try and achieve the magic reduction in calories. That is what you've got to. That's what you've got to do.
And that's the magic.
Yes.
Thank you so much. So fascinating. Well, much more on all of this, of course, in Giles's book. It's called Gene Eating, and it is out now. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
That is all we have time for today. But don't forget, we'll put the notes from this episode up on LizelleWellbeing.com. And you'll also find further resources and the chance to sign up for our free weekly newsletter, which comes right to your inbox for an end of week treat each and every Friday, should you so wish. So until the next time we chat, go well. Bye-bye.